everyone, and welcome back to the new Plaza Cinema Podcast, the podcast made by cinephiles for cinephiles. This time around, we're discussing Martin Ritz's 1976 film, The Front, which explores Hollywood's dark history of censorship and blacklisting during the McCarthy era, and features formerly blacklisted talents such as writer Walter Bernstein and actor Zira Mostel. In addition, we also have famed actress Andrea Marcovici joining us to discuss her experiences on set when she played the female lead opposite Woody Allen in The Front, marking her film debut. So with all that being said, we hope you enjoy this special episode.
I have a very unusual personal story regarding The Front, which is kind of lengthy, so I'm just going to tell the beginning of it. In late September 1976, when The Front was first released in theaters, 47 years ago, and I had not seen it since until this morning, I found myself in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club as part of a press junket. I was my senior year in college, but I got invited on this press junket to hear Woody Allen speak to the National Press Club as part of a promotional effort for The Front and its issue of The Blacklist. And many of the questions were kind of frivolous and not really on point. I remember one reporter asking him if he had written some of the screenplay. And he did say that he was working. He had just finished shooting a film. He didn't have a title for it yet, but it was going to be a romantic comedy released in the spring of 1977. Well, we all know what that movie eventually became, and it changed his career, and it kind of changed, you know, American filmmaking in some ways. But these are tangential things. And I want to move over to Max now, who gave that beautiful presentation of The Blacklist last Wednesday. This is one of his bailiwick subjects. And he has the trailer for the film as well. Max.
I remember another trailer, seeing that at a Repertory Cinema, which played up the comedy jokey aspects of the film. There was a narrator. There was perhaps some whimsical music. You saw the Woody Allen Howard Prince character going around taking bets, telling Danny Aiello he's going to pay him his money. And that was clearly designed to get the masses in. But this is more serious and is very faithful to the original print campaign of the film when it opened in select markets in October of 1976. And I do think it captures the spirit of the film very effectively.
What if there was a list? A list that said our finest actors weren't allowed to act. Our best writers weren't allowed to write. Our funniest comedians weren't allowed to make us laugh. What would this country be like if there was such a list? It would be like America in 1953.
Very tasteful. I mean, it really does convey the story very, very effectively.
Good trailer. You know, Martin Ritz is one of those directors that was blacklisted. He managed to wiggle out of it by the mid-50s and had made his first feature, Edge of the City, John Cassavetes and Sidney Poitier, and also Paris Blues, which we did a program on here a couple of years ago, and that movie keeps bouncing back somehow, and people's attention or gets shown here and there. It's become better appreciated, but also films like HUD and Hombre, the Molly Maguires, Sounder, Norma Ray, the kind of career that unfortunately an American filmmaker can't have anymore, just for any number of reasons.
He's part of the generation that was allowed to make films produced by Hollywood studios and distributed by studios about adults and adult relationships and even dramas, which they've made virtually impossible to get made, at least at the studio level.
Yeah, you know, there's like Arthur Penn, Sidney Pollack, John Frankenheimer, Sidney
Lumet. You know, so many of them. He had been working with the group theater, and he got a lot of directing training in the 1930s with the Federal Theater Project's New Deal program, where, of course, you know, Orson Welles and others and even Elia Kazan had worked. So he told an unusual story about how he got out of The Blacklist. You mentioned Edge of the City, which was at MGM. He said that he was having a meeting with the head of Lowe's. I don't know if it was Nick Skank or one of the successors, who wanted Ritz to cooperate with the HUAC committee. And Ritz said, no, I'm not going to cooperate. I'm not going to give them names of people. And that the executive said, all right, kid, that's okay. Let's make our picture. I mean, I've never heard of another case like that. But nonetheless, in 1957, he is allowed to become a director in Hollywood while this blacklist is still taking place. And we also have the actors Zero Mostel and Herschel Bernardi and Lloyd Goff and Joshua Shelley in the cast, who were blacklisted, as the film very powerfully states at the end.
I'm forgetting now, maybe you remember back, the circumstances under which Woody Allen got involved in this project. His career was still kind of, you know, budding, and so his pictures were getting better reviewed and doing better box office. Everything About Sex, Sleeper, Love and Death. And this film was made between Love and Death and the untitled film known as Annie Hall, which he had just finished shooting at the time.
And you're right. And no one has ever connected these two together, because even when Annie Hall came out, I said, hey, wait a minute. Silent, white on black letters, the front open that way. So I suspect that Woody Allen was influenced by some of the technique that was used in the front. It's just a theory. I would have liked to have known more, and I was discussing this with someone else. I would have loved to have seen some of the early screenplays, the drafts of the script by Walter Bernstein. Martin Ritt was interviewed in this book, Tender Comrades, which is very compelling.
Patrick McGilligan.
Exactly. Patrick McGilligan. Exactly.
A Wisconsin comrade of yours.
Exactly. I know. There's that name again, Wisconsin. The interviewer asked him or mentioned that he had said at one point that it should never have been a comedy, The Front. Ritt responded with, quote, "We started to write a more serious film. The film was originally about Hecky, the Zero Mostel character. Halfway through, Walter Bernstein and I decided it was going to be maudlin and sentimental. So together we came up with the notion of The Front. We remembered the story because it really happened, and we can talk more about that, and decided that's what the film should be, and that's what the film became. I would like to make another picture that deals more seriously with that time and that subject. It might have a chance to be a better film. Unfortunately, that didn't come to pass." Walter Bernstein, and this is where I get frustrated with writers sometimes, he's interviewed in this book, Tender Comrades, and they don't ask him about The Front. How can you not ask the writer of a film about the blacklist about the writing of that script? The only thing we got out of Bernstein in that interview was he mentioned that in 1988, it was screened at the Barcelona Film Festival with several blacklisted actors in attendance, and that the notorious Hollywood 10 member Edward Dmytryk was there. He was the director who was the one who ended up squealing to HUAC in order to save his Hollywood career after when he went to jail, and that Dmytryk tried to disrupt the screening of The Front after the screening in Barcelona. Other than that, they didn't get any additional information out of Bernstein, unfortunately.
Walter Bernstein lived to be a ripe old age, over 100, I believe.
101?
He appeared at the Lincoln, our late lamented Lincoln Plaza Cinema on the day of the New York City Marathon in 2016, when a documentary called By Sidney Lumet was being screened that day by a director who passed away, sadly, at a much younger age recently, Nancy Bersky. If you've seen that doc, it's a very meticulous and loving portrait of Sidney Lumet. And of course, and Bernstein worked on Failsafe with Lumet and a couple of his other pictures.
He was cut off at the knees fairly early in his career. His only feature before his blacklisting was he worked on the adaptation of the film noir Kiss the Blood Off My Hands, one of my all-time favorite titles.
One of the weirdest titles of all time for Hollywood.
And then he was in television from 50 to 55, and then apparently that's when things got ugly with the blacklist. He worked on shows like Danger and You Are There, and then in the late 50s, his TV work picks up a little bit. Then by the 60s, as you mentioned, we have some of those films, Paris Blues and The Train and Failsafe. And it's a little quiet. In fact, the 70s was pretty quiet, except for several films he wrote for Martin Ritt during that time.
The Molly Maguires, I think that was...
Exactly. That was the one before.
Very ambitious production, a film that deserves to be better now.
I totally agree with you. And I'm sorry, but you know me, I always like to embrace controversy, but it would be irresponsible, I feel, not to say this in some way, but the timing of this is very sobering, because as of this date in 2023, the star of The Front, Woody Allen, remains a blacklisted Hollywood director. He hasn't had officially a film released in this country since 2017. His recent comedy, Rifkin's Festival, had a very brief show here in New York at the Quad Theater in early 22, more than a year after its completion. This past Labor Day, his newest film, coup de chance in French, had a rousing reception in Venice, and the 87-year-old Woody Allen got a standing ovation. The trailer looks really good, but the question remains, will we have a chance to see this film in our cinemas?
That sounds like it's one of his better pictures in quite some time.
It does sound that way. And when he made The Front, apparently he felt a bit detached from the experiences of the blacklistees. I suspect he feels more of a connection today. I had known quite a bit about The Front when I saw it originally, and when watching it again, and I last saw it 17 or 18 years ago, I was very impressed by how the filmmakers were able to summarize these very complicated points. I mean, it really is a superb starting point for people if you don't know much about that era in terms of laying out what the HUAC committee was like, what happened to people who testified, the legal ramifications. This is a massive subject, and I think the film, yes, could they have done more? Of course. But I think for the key points, it deserves credit for making it accessible to people who might not be familiar with the subject.
I think kind of a classic example of narrative concision in 94 minutes, no less, which you rarely see today.
Yes, it's true. It's amazing how quick the movie is. And in watching it this time, because I always think from an editor's perspective, they really were trying to keep things moving along. You'll notice there are a couple of scenes where dialogue continues as we cut to the next scene. And clearly the original scene was much longer, but they wanted to keep it moving. Not a frame is wasted. I wouldn't have minded it to be a little longer, but yes, it's amazing what they were able to convey in that time. Mm-hmm. And the Hecky Brown character of Zero Mostel had its origins in the actor Philip Loeb, who had co-starred with Gertrude Berg on the hit TV series The Goldbergs in the early 50s. And he was blacklisted and did end up committing suicide. So the Hecky Brown character was based on Philip Loeb. And I believe the original conception, and we have some more information that people can share, was to focus more on that. And that when Woody Allen came aboard, obviously the focus shifted a bit.
Of course, the additional pathos of seeing Zero Mostel near the end of his life. I think he died maybe only a year or so after this was completed under apparently tragic circumstances. He was on some kind of crash diet or starvation diet, and he collapsed in Philadelphia shooting something or other and could not revive him.
That is very sad because he did die in 1977, and he had a long blacklist from Hollywood. He was blacklisted from 1951 to 66. 66 was when he made the film version of The Funny Thing Happen on the way to the Forum. He did have success on Broadway before that time in the 60s, Fiddler on the Roof, of course, and A Funny Thing Happened on Broadway. But there was a long break between films. And Herschel Bernardi had some feature work in unbilled roles in the late 40s, and then there was virtually nothing until the late 50s where he starts appearing in television. Lloyd Goff had made films. Lloyd Goff was the white-haired TV writer who was part of Howard Circles.
He makes no bones about being a communist and even invites Woody Allen's character to a meeting or something.
Exactly. And he will be remembered from being the gangster in Body and Soul. He is the bad guy in that film. He had been in films from around 1940 to 52. His last film was for Fritz Lang, Rancho Notorious. And then there was virtually nothing for the next 12 years upon which he was working steadily in television. So this is what it was like for those who, clearly had been or had dalliances with certain aspects of the Communist Party. But you didn't necessarily have to have been in the Communist Party to receive that kind of exile if you didn't want to cooperate with the committee.
Well, might this be a good time to introduce the special guest that we are?
Well, we do have a special guest, but we're all about teasing people here, Gary.
Okay.
I think we should hear from Dan Cahill.
I'll subscribe to that.
Our filmmaker and cinematographer specialist who can discuss the look and feel of The Front. And then we are going to introduce our special guest. Go ahead. Okay. Welcome.
Whose thunder I promised not to steal. Okay. I want to just address one point, and that's about the cinematographer, Michael Chapman, who was prominent, had a distinguished career. He photographed Taxi Driver, and he was nominated for an Oscar for both The Fugitive and Raging Bull. So my point in citing this is I do not feel that this is Mr. Chapman's one of his better films. I don't really view it as a particularly strong film from the point of view of camera and visual artistry.
I will defend the look of the film because I did think it's a look that was consistent with Woody Allen's directing moving forward. I'm thinking of the opening scene in the diner, which is a single camera take. There isn't a lot of cutting back and forth between characters. There are other scenes, particularly between Woody Allen and the leading lady in a restaurant, that the camera tracks over to them and then maintains stationary as they're talking. The master shot is something that Woody Allen himself began embracing more in his work. Now, granted, the film that became Annie Hall would have already been in probably in editing stages at this point.
Yeah.
I just find it interesting that Woody Allen's style changed a bit after The Front came out, as is a director, and even though he didn't direct The Front.
I would like to interject one of the bigger influences on Woody's career at that point was his hiring Gordon Willis as his cinematographer. And clearly he learned mountains of things from Gordon, which kept him in business for the rest of his career, even though they only collaborated on a few films.
And Michael Chapman was, I think, an operator or an assistant to Gordon Willis on The Godfather and some other pictures from the early 70s.
And the same year that Chapman photographed The Front, earlier that year, he did a very intense, lower-budgeted film for Martin Scorsese, Taxi Driver, a different look at New York City. All right, well, we've kept you in suspense long enough. We have to welcome an incredibly special guest, an actress from The Front, which was her very first film. Before that, she had been appearing on television in films and series. In addition to her radiant screen presence and powerful acting skills, she is graced with a stunning singing voice. She's recorded an impressive discography, which includes major entries from the Great American Songbook. She's acted on Broadway. Ladies and gentlemen of New Plaza Cinema, it gives me great pleasure to welcome the woman who played story editor Florence Barrett in The Front, Andrea Markovici. Welcome, Miss Markovici.
Well, hello. This is a thrilling conversation. I'm learning so much about something I did so long ago.
But Andrea, you were really thrown into the deep end kind of in this movie, weren't you?
I really was, because I was 25, I think, at the time. Or 24. I think I celebrated my 25th birthday on set. They gave me a huge cake and a party and all the rest. Very exciting time for me.
So how did it start? How did you end up getting associated with this project?
The normal way. I went to an audition at the most famous casting director at the time. Woody was at the audition, but his back was turned to me. He wouldn't even look at me. He read with me. The next audition was the callback, and they said, "You've got the part." So it wasn't really a very long process. It was really exciting. And I remember going into the area in front of the Plaza Hotel and throwing my hat in the air like Mary Tyler Moore. And hilarious. I loved making this movie. Loved it. Zero was particularly kind to me. Woody was very quiet, and he would, he never tried to make the crew laugh. You know, everybody thought a comedian is a comedian, but that's not true. He would make me laugh privately in my ear. So when we got to the kissing scene up at the fort way uptown, he whispered in my ear, "I'm only going to give you one lip. Because if I give you two lips, you're not going to be able to stand it." And so I was in hysterics, blowing the scene, and no one knew why I was laughing. So he would do tricks like that to me all the time. Zero, on the other hand, was absolutely universally hilarious at all times, trying to make the crew laugh. So they were opposites, absolute opposites. I enjoyed this so much, so much. But I would like to say that one of the reasons that the movie never took off is because Columbia, the heads of Columbia, they never read the script. They never read it. They had Zero Mostel and Woody Allen, and they thought it was a comedy. period. And when they saw it, they dropped it like a hot potato. They did no press. They did no support. When I was nominated for a Golden Globe, they would not even fly me out to California. Mm. They didn't want anything to do with this movie. It was really tragic.
That's really powerful. I remember being an out-of-towner, I always looked at the Sunday New York Times movie ads, and I do remember a full page, it was a two-page ad for The Front opening exclusively. I suspect maybe they did that because they didn't want Woody Allen on their case for not supporting the film in New York. But I do remember once it played the Hinterlands.
Well, and no support for it, no support whatsoever. And I honestly think it was because they really didn't know what they had. They really thought it was going to be hilarious because of Bananas and all the other things that Woody had done. And because they had Woody and Zero, they thought it was going to be a nonstop comedy. They honestly didn't know that they had a serious picture on their hands. And it was serious, but it was serial comedy. And it was wonderful. And I'm so glad it has reached its audience throughout the years. This is such a long-lasting and, I think, eternal movie. I think it will always be loved. I'm so proud to be in it. Whenever anybody asks me, what's your favorite picture? It's my first picture, and I'm still so proud of it.
Andrea, I have a question. We have been talking over the last couple of weeks of preparing for this, speculating about what Walter Bernstein's original script was like. Did you ever see a previous version prior to this shooting script?
No, I saw the shooting script, and I must tell you that Woody didn't add a lot to it. Like, we weren't improvising on the set or anything like that. I mean, it was really Walter's work, truly Walter's work. Woody helped me be funnier, not without using the lines that were on the script. He just helped me learn to be funny. And by that, I mean, just stay serious and you'll be funny. Which I learned again with Danny DeVito when I did Taxi. Everybody just said, just be your serious self and you'll be hilarious. Right. I was told that many times in my career. Just stay serious. Just be more serious and you'll be funnier still. Eventually, I became a comic when I started doing cabaret. But in my movie career, no, just stay serious. You'll be hilarious.
Good advice.
It's the old adage, if you laugh, the audience won't.
Right. It was. I mean, especially with, you're a cashier.
Right.
Funniest line in the picture. If I had not been completely gobsmacked in that line, it wouldn't have gotten a laugh.
And Martin Ritt himself had an acting background. Any wisdom you can share or observations or memories about how he worked with you as an actor and what he may have brought as someone with acting experience to his actors? How did he work with you? How did he work with others?
Gently. He was a very gentle gentleman, very gentle. He just guided. You know, there wasn't a lot of bringing me into the corner and telling me what to do or anything like that. And well, one of the only things that I have to say is not totally positive. I think they wanted to quit for the day and have a conference. And he looked at me and he said, Andrea, you look tired. Let's quit. I was 25. You look tired? Oh, please. That was so paternal and Me Too-ish. You know, I'm tired. I looked perfect. I was 25. I wasn't going to look tired again for 15 years. But I wanted to have a conference and they wanted somebody to blame. So I was tired. I think it's hysterical. To this day, I still laugh about that. But okay, I left.
Directors by nature are master manipulators. Okay. And that's what he was doing.
There you got it. And I've never forgotten it. Don't you think that's hysterical?
Well, let me ask you this. As this 25-year-old upstart, how much did you know about the whole Blacklist story going into this project?
So glad you asked me that question. A great big zero. I went to Catholic school. The only thing I knew about the Blacklist was better dead than red. Big poster with a skull. I went to 12 years of Marymount with nuns. It was a big poster. And as we walked up the stairs, I saw that. So when I got cast, I read everything I could find. I probably consumed every book that was available so that I would be wise on the set. And I had enough time. When I was cast, I was actually playing opposite Sam Waterston in the park playing Ophelia. And I was singing at night, too. I had to hurry up and catch up. But by the time I was actually shooting, I was pretty well-versed. I had done my homework. And as a good Catholic girl, I had underlined every book I could find.
Were there interactions with some of the blacklisted actors about their experiences? Obviously, I know Zero Mostel was kidding around a lot, but were there any heart-to-heart discussions about what some of them had gone through during the production?
More with Walter. Walter took me under his wing, and he was more helpful because as the writer of the script, he was much more inclined to help me out. Zero was more of the jokester and constantly joking. We shared these little cubicles. Instead of dressing rooms, we were all in one huge soundstage. And we had cubicles and no ceilings. No ceilings, just wall and then open. And he was outrageous, completely outrageous. And if I had a friend visiting, I'm sorry, this is going to be a little off color.
Oh, but please, go for it.
Shut up out there. I'm farting. I loved him to pieces. He was hysterical. I will never get over him. He was so funny. Never. And it's so sweet to me, too. He would, in a shot, he'd say, "You're not catching the light, Andrea. You're not catching the light. Lift up, lift up." No, oh, divine. Divine. What a guy.
That's fantastic. He had dealt with difficulties on Broadway in the 50s during blacklisting, which I was surprised to hear because many of us have always been led to believe that the blacklist was not as strictly enforced on Broadway as it was in film and television and radio. But yet Mostel suffered quite a bit.
And I never knew that. It's horrible. Absolutely.
Literally, he got the part and fiddled around the roof. I guess that would have been like in the early 60s, right? In the
right. 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 And of course, that made him world famous.
As Ken Duran said in the doc about Fiddler that we played here last year, yeah, he was one of these actors. He could play both to the front row and the very last row of the theater somehow in his performance set.
There are tricks for that.
And you certainly get a sense of that in the film because his discussion of the hotel room scene, how Mostel is playing to the front row of the audience, and then we see some of the more outlandish comic antics that he does in other elements of the film.
I think that scene in the hotel room is just genius. As you see the curtain, instead of seeing him, you see the curtain blow. It's just stunning.
And the champagne bottle on the windowsill.
Yeah, that's a great touch.
Absolutely magnificent. Magnificent way to tell the story.
The high point of the film.
I timed it. 2 minutes, 35 seconds.
Yeah.
Genius. Genius. I love it.
And people are not aware, because you have that, forgive me, I believe you have the line about the gas company sponsor not wanting to sponsor the concentration camp. That's a true story. That happened.
Talk about having to keep a straight face.
But that actually happened on a live TV.
That was a little, they think it makes gas look bad.
No, but it took me back to when I first saw the film. It was an advanced screening at the university in Milwaukee, and a buddy of mine who knew his stuff, when you said that line, he said loud enough, "That's a true story. That happened." So.
I tell you, that was a little hard to say. It was almost as hard when I had the role in Taxi and I had to say to Louis de Palma, "Frankly, in the light of day, you're gross and disgusting. With a straight face. No, these things are very difficult to do.
Well, let me ask you this. Were there scenes or material that you remember filming in the front that got deleted during the editing process? Things that you were sorry to see go or just recall making but not appearing in the final film?
And tell me, is this 50 years ago or no?
I don't mean to put you on the spot. Well,
there was a scene in the park somewhere that I have a picture of us walking in Central Park, and I have a memory of us in Central Park. Is there a scene in Central Park?
Yes.
Oh, good. Because that I don't remember seeing. But that's all. I have a picture of us walking in Central Park. But I don't remember seeing it in the movie. But I don't think they cut anything. I really don't.
Because there is a scene between the two of you where Woody Allen's character is talking. And at one point, he leaves the frame and the camera remains on you. And then he re-enters the frame. And once again, that's a style of directing. We're going to see more from him in the future. I'm just saying. I thought that was very interesting. I don't think...
You know what? I've told him everything he knows.
See? I don't think people are aware, or maybe they've forgotten, that the front really was groundbreaking because Hollywood had not acknowledged this ugly chapter of its history so overtly before. They had alluded to the blacklist in other kinds of films symbolically, if you could read between the lines. But in this case, this was the first time it was happening.
And Matt, you may remember that same year. There's a very good documentary released around the same time as the fact called Hollywood on Trial, by a couple of Boston-based filmmakers where I was living at the time. And that got a long run at the Orson Welles Cinema in Cambridge, Kakara with the front's release, and was Oscar nominated, I think, too. And there have been other docs on the subject, of course.
Nice.
It's a terrific documentary. Yeah. And I remember seeing it when it originally aired, so I was all primed for the front when it came out.
Well, I remember a Pauline Kael review.
Uh-oh,
she was really mean to me. That's the only review I remember. Oh, yes. She said that I looked like Joan Hackett. That's all I remember. Remember Joan Hackett?
Dark Shadows.
And that's all I remember.
Seldom does a day go by when I don't curse that woman's memory. I think there was so much aggression from her. To the point where I ask myself, why are you in this job, lady? You obviously hate film so much. But don't take that to heart. She did it to the best of them. And she...
Between her worker leader.
Oh, he was even worse in some respects. But she was a good one to on this subject because she often... I was reminded of this earlier today. I called her a reactionary in liberal clothing. She'd like to claim to be sort of a counterculture troublemaker. But ultimately... She was very, very hostile towards blacklistees. And there's a wonderful book called Hide in Plain Sight. I want to say Buell and Wagner may perhaps wrote that, which deals with the Hollywood writers and some actors and directors who returned from the blacklist to try to reenter show business, and how there was this whole circle of critics, among them Pauline Kael, who would go out of their way to slam their work. She slammed Dalton Trumbo. She obviously was not happy with a movie like The Front as well. I am sorry that happened to you.
I will tell you, as a decades-long New Yorker reader, I eventually came to see her as a reverse barometer. If she loved something, I wouldn't go, etc. She's just so, obnoxious, in a word.
I had it out with her on the stage at the James Doolittle Theater in early 1984. I just want you to know. I challenged her on one of her stupid opinions, and she got very upset and didn't know how to deal with this young upstart child. But so, anyhow.
Good for you.
The proof is in the pudding that we're still talking about The Front.
Exactly.
This discussion was facilitated by film historian Max Alvarez, resident film curator Gary Palmucci, and cinematography expert Dan Cahill. Also, special thanks to Norma Levy, Marianne Tesler, Sean Moore, and Polly Rittenberg for making this podcast episode possible. And last but certainly not least, we'd love to thank our guest, Andrea Marcovici, for joining us and discussing the lore of the film. This podcast was produced, edited, and narrated by Hannah Kavanaugh. Yours truly. Thank you so much for listening, and be sure to keep an eye out for our next live talk back on October 8th, which covers the spooky slapstick comedy, Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. In the meantime, take care, everyone.